Welcome to EIR Talks. On August 31, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche gave the keynote address at the Labor Day Conference of the International Caucus of Labor Committees and Schiller Institute, convened in Reston, Virginia. This week, part two of the keynote and responses to questions are presented as the second of a series of programs dedicated to this historic conference.
However, this is more or less an individual or narrow social activity. It is not the whole society. In order to conduct these kinds of activities, you must create the environment which is needed for such activities. For example, from the beginning of the Americas as a colonization process, the constant process was to try to build a continent, to reach from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, from Penn's Colony and so forth, and to reach westward through natural routes of progress, waterways and so forth. And so in the early part of the 18th century, the great development in the United States, or what became the United States, was the development of highways and waterways, ocean coastal waterways, inland waterways, and so forth. In the course of time, then the railroad came into process. Now we can move from dependent upon waterways to across land mass transit by the railroad system. And the railroad is not simply a system of communication. The railroad is a avenue of development on both sides of the railroad, now which connect interior parts of the country to the coastal areas. You now have towns springing up, farms springing up, other things springing up around the railroad, which the system of communication and transportation makes possible. They have large-scale water systems, as we took the southern part of the Mississippi River and the Ohio River Valley and things like that. And these things create conditions for the improvement of the quality of production, increase of the productive powers of labor. The development of new energy resources, going from raw water power and coal burning in England in the earlier on in the 16th century, continuing into the 19th century, we went into improved forms of use of heat power. Started largely with Leibniz and Leibniz's promotion of the development of heat power as a notion of power to increase the productive powers of labor. That spread over the course of the 18th century. The development of followers of Leibniz, such as James Watt, who was sent down to France to work with Lavoisier to develop the Watt steam engine. And then you had the process of improvements in reduction. Also, Lavoisier was important in that. So then in the course of the 19th century, there's a rapid development of technology. And at this point, we now get to new, more powerful sources of heat power. In the latter part of the century, we develop electrical power on a large scale, largely due to the initiatives of Gauss and people around him, his collaborators. In the beginning of the 20th century, we suddenly had a revolution in productivity as we went from factories which were driven by steam engines with belt and pulley systems to power the machines to individually electrically powered, motor-powered machines. And this introduction of the electrically powered machinery in plants was one of the great revolutions in the process of technology. So all of these things involved the development of very large-scale transformations of land areas, water areas, transportation, and so forth. It also required something else. It required the development of the population. Now, the development of the population meant, again, something which beyond the scope of the individual entrepreneur, just as large-scale railroad systems are beyond the scope of the individual private entrepreneur, as large-scale water management systems are beyond that, as land management systems are beyond that, so you have general education. We have to have a level of education consistent with the needs of the population as a whole, as a functioning population, consistent with the idea of transmitting the knowledge from previous generations to the present, needed to keep the society on keel and going ahead. This cannot be the function of private entrepreneurship. It's the function of government. And in the United States system, government means federal government, it means state government, it means municipal government. It means other institutions. And these agencies are responsible to create, to regulate essential forms of basic economic infrastructure, which provide the tilled field in which the crop of entrepreneurship can be planted. It means healthcare systems. It means a lot more DDT right now. It means going back to Hill Burton and to end with HMO. It means those kinds of things. It means so therefore there's a relationship between what we call hard infrastructure, such as transportation systems, especially like things like rail, magnetic levitation, water systems, air systems, and so forth. And then the soft ones, which are general systems of education and of healthcare, which must be developed according to the needs of the population in its development to overcome existing problems and also to clear the way to be able to conquer new ones. So this is the responsibility of government. And government must regulate this infrastructure. It must also regulate other things that I've just indicated. But it must regulate infrastructure, and it must, in many cases, undertake the construction or development of infrastructure. It may also farm out infrastructure in the form of utilities, either federal utilities, state franchise utilities, state regulated utilities, county utilities, municipal utilities. That government assumes its responsibility for the infrastructure or part of the infrastructure of an area and may take care of the job itself or may do it jointly through regulation with a partly or entirely privately owned public utility. That's infrastructure. There's another aspect of infrastructure, which is the monetary financial system. Now, money is evil. It's not the root of all evil. It is evil. Because when money puts a value on itself, it becomes evil. Because a piece of paper or a statistic suddenly says, I'm the boss. You human beings are my slaves. You work for me. Money makes money. I don't know, it's breeding in the back room or something, but anyway, money makes money. It's not, money is actually just a medium of exchange. That's all it ever should be. And under our system, the American system, as defined, for example, by Alexander Hamilton, the American system, money is created by the federal government, according to the Constitution, by law. And no currency may be issued except by the federal government by law. So money comes from the government. The control of money must be by national banking, not private banking. And money must be regulated. Its circulation must be regulated. So money is an instrument of government, which is controlled, created and controlled for the benefit of the nation and for the people who live in it. Because if it's allowed to run out on its own, as with usury, or as we've seen in recent periods since Nixon, it's a menace. So we have to control it. We have to manage the money in a sensible way, which means you need a good money system, carefully regulated and supervised. You cannot let the accountants run the system. You must have the system run the accountants. You see, shouldn't you trust an accountant? Never trust an accountant to do anything except what he's supposed to do. Because the accountant will tell you, particularly the most idiotic ones, with the highest paid, usually, because they have no conscience. That's a luxury item, and they get paid more for that. The accountant says the key to accounting is the bottom line. Well, the bottom line is nothing. The bottom line doesn't mean anything. If you reduce the expenditure for necessary costs and thus far in generate a profit on the bottom line, what have you done? You've stolen. You've done nothing. The accountant assumes that by connecting the dots among financial figures that you can derive an explanation of why the result occurred. But it's not. It's just simply a way of accounting for the flow of money. It may reflect something, but the rules by which money is accounted for, the rules for accounting must be set as a standard by government. Otherwise, you have the wrong kind of system. For example, the problem we face concretely is this. The United States' uniqueness as an economic system, the American system of political economy, is a result of something which is a historical accident, but not exactly an accident. For over a thousand years ago, with the decline and disintegration of the Byzantine Empire, Venice emerged as an imperial maritime power throughout Europe and the Mediterranean region. Venice was controlled by a financier oligarchy. Venice ran all of the Crusades. Venice ran all of the wars in conjunction with Venice's partners, the Normans, Plantagenets, Anjou, and so forth. All the Crusades, all the wars were run by Venice. And Venice used these wars to prevent the rise of nation-states, which was already a tendency since Charlemagne. Charlemagne's empire actually set into motion the impulse to develop nation-states. Venice moved to destroy that, to frustrate that. And from that point on, there was a conflict between the so-called German emperors and monarchs and this force around Venice. The tendency was, as with famously with the case of Frederick II Hohenstaufen in Italy and Alfonso Sabio in Spain, the tendency was to develop nation-states under which the general welfare of the people was the accountability of a monarch. And therefore, the monarchical government would make law in the interest of the general welfare. That was the impulse, which eventually led to the formation of the first modern nation-state in Louis Onze's France and later in England under Henry VII. So Venice was always opposed to this, and it used the so-called ultramontane issue of having a super government. They would sometimes try to use the papacy as a super government to eliminate all possibility of national government from existing in Europe. When the Venetian system collapsed, and it collapsed finally after 1648. Venice organized religious wars in Europe from 1511 approximately to 1648 to attempt to destroy the emergence of the nation state which had occurred in the previous 15th century. But after that, the Treaty of Westphalia, which was organized largely by Jules Cardinal Mazarin, who had been the diplomat for Pope Urban III, and broke the power of Venice and led to the emergence of nation-states, beginning with France under Colbert. Colbert's effort was later destroyed by Louis XIV, but nonetheless the effort was made. And this was the context in which modern European civilization emerged out of the Treaty of Westphalia, out of the so-called 30 Years' War. So, but in that period, as Venice declined, about 1670 or so forth, began to fall apart, the Venetians were succeeded by an Anglo-Dutch oligarchy which was guided by Venice in its creation and which was an imitation of Venice. So this oligarchy, which was consolidated under William of Orange, the tyrant who later took over England and Scotland and Wales and so forth, this became also the British East India Company. So the Dutch and British East India Companies became the dominant forces in so-called Protestant Europe. Outside of Europe, the dominant forces outside France in particular were the feudalistic governments of the Habsburgs and people like that. So Europe was divided between this. Now, in this process, what has emerged as the modern nation state in Europe is not a republic like the United States, in no sense, constitutionally. It is an outcome of a Venetian model of imperial maritime power based on a financier oligarchical interest. The central institution of that oligarchical power in the continent of Europe is the central banking system. The central banking system is an aggregation of private banks, a private banking and financial interests, which have forced upon governments a concession that the so-called political government will be submitted to the supervision and control of a central banking system, which is what happened to the federal in creating the unconstitutional Federal Reserve System of the United States. The Federal Reserve System of the United States was created by King Edward VII of England. King Edward VII of England had a banker. Huh? The banker had an agent in New York, Jacob Schiff. The New York banker, together with the Teddy Roosevelt crowd, designed the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was put into power illegally by a Bull Moose campaign by Teddy Roosevelt, such that the Wilson administration, the Ku Klux Klan fanatic Wilson, put through, or was presided over putting through, the Federal Reserve System and also the income tax, among other things. The populace like to complain about that. So that since that time, the United States itself has been controlled and corrupted by a Federal Reserve System, which is an echo of the Venetian model of central banking system, which dominates Western Europe. So therefore, the United States Constitution is violated not only in technicality, but in principle by the existence of a central banking system or the equivalent in this form. During Roosevelt's tenure, elected for four terms, Roosevelt, by leading the United States out of the Great Depression, accumulated such political power with the population that he was able to resist and to provide a check on the power of the Federal Reserve System and the people behind it. The minute that Roosevelt was dead, or within an hour or two of his death, when the news reached Washington, Roosevelt's successors, who hated him, moved to try to destroy the system, his system. And thus, we had immediately, in the 1940s, we had this process. They couldn't get rid of what Roosevelt had done immediately. It took them another 20 years to get to that point with the beginning of the Indochina War. But they began to tear it down. And so our problem in the United States has been that we do not today know our own history. We do not know the nature of our republic. We do not understand the nature of the opponents of our republic, that is, the Venetian model, which still dominates Europe and corrupts the minds of Europeans. We don't understand economics because we try to say that the United States is a form of capitalism like England. Well, it isn't. The United States is not a capitalist economy. The United States economy, the American system of political economy as defined by Hamilton and others, is not British capitalism, quite the opposite. It is a form of nation state and national economy, as the famous Friedrich List described it, the national system of political economy. The difference is the so-called capitalist system, as the British case defines it, as poor Marx defined it, is based on the assumption that the central banking interest must remain independent, and that the government must be responsive to the control by the central banking interest. The United States system, the American system of political economy, in all its manifestations, except for outright traitors and fools, has always been dependent on the assumption that the people, the sovereign people of the United States, are the controllers of the credit, currency, and currency of the United States, and regulate the currency and regulate the economy according to laws which are designed to cause the functioning of the economy to flow into channels which are consistent with the intent of the Constitution, the promotion of the general welfare and progress, which means the promotion of the nature of man as an individual made in the limited image of the Creator. That's the law, specified in the preamble. Sovereignty. The United States government is absolutely sovereign in all matters in its territory. That government. And it's our government. We the people. It's our government, not somebody else's. Second, the United States and all aspects of its law and constitution are subject to the principle of the general welfare. otherwise known in ancient Greek as agape, otherwise known as general welfare, otherwise known as common good, sometimes called commonwealth. Thirdly, that this is qualified by the fact that we are as accountable to our posterity as we are to our contemporaries. You can do nothing which is bad for your grandchildren. We are supposed to be a people which is sufficiently conscious of these considerations, that we as a people, fussing and arguing with one another through channels which we develop as institutions, will deliberate with these principles in mind and will try to come to an honest conclusion about what best serves that constitutional purpose. This is our government. It is our friend. Sometimes you have to get the rats and mice out of the house, but it's our friend otherwise. All right, now this, so therefore, we have this relationship. We have the relationship between entrepreneurship, which is only a typical aspect of economy, of a private economy, the action of the voluntary individual using the creative powers of reason and assimilating the transmission of knowledge from previous generations to do some good. The general idea is we promote the doing of good. It's what Benjamin Franklin based the design of the Republic on. I caught in Mather before him. To do good. The purpose of mankind, the purpose of the nation is to do good in the sense of agape. So we deliberate on that and we decide what is right. If we made a mistake, we correct it. That's our government. That's our friend. That's the best we can do. Man cannot do better. We cannot absolutely eliminate error, but we can be accountable for trying to do good for all mankind as well as ourselves. Therefore, we must first of all, through government, focus upon the general basic economic infrastructure, which includes transportation, which includes not only transportation, water for as transportation, but water as other purposes. It means also the provision of power. It means ports. It means health care. It means education. These are matters of basic economic infrastructure for which the government must be responsible, because it is something which concerns all of the land area and all of the people and all of the activities of the nation. We then, providing this field, this tilled and fertilized field of infrastructure, we then say to the people, go out and do some good. And if you need help, we might help you. We'll pass laws to help you succeed, to regulate things so that you have a chance to succeed. Go out and do good. You're the entrepreneurs. We'll allow joint stock corporations, even though we don't trust them. We know they're inherently bad. But we'll, if they're needed, we'll regulate them and hope that somehow the spirit of entrepreneurship might infect them. We promote discovery. We promote new ideas, especially scientific and related cultural ideas. We promote that which is beautiful in the sense that it captures the essence of humanity. For example, like we have mentioned the Passion of St. John and Passion of St. Matthew. These are objects of beauty. Why? Because the despondent person coming into a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, and it's probably done, is going to experience the Passion and Crucifixion of Christ. And unlike my erring friend, the pastor, he will not think that Christ made a mistake. He will think that Christ was doing something for all mankind and exemplifying what every one of us must aspire to do for mankind in our own lives in our own way. Life is our coin. Mortal life is our coin. Spend it wisely. Spend it for the good. Look ahead to coming generations and think what you will wish you had spent it for. That experience of discovery of an idea, lifting oneself out of the muck of despair and frustration into a sense of the nobility of mankind, as the Saint Matthew Passion does this, is beauty. It is true beauty. And this sense of beauty is, in the final analysis, the most powerful force in humanity, the sense of the beautiful. Beauty will motivate you as nothing else can do. A sense of beauty in that sense, that kind of beauty. Not the tangible beauty. Because, for example, the beautiful thing about a great Greek classical Greek sculpture is not the physical object. The beauty, say, in a great carving by the classical Greek sculptors is a paradox. What you see is a still body, a carved still figure. What you think is not a still body, but a body in mid-motion, an instant of mid-motion. That sense of capturing something in mid-motion, which seems to be still, that seeing beyond the limitations of perception, is the key to the idea of beauty. It is also the idea of truth, as the famous poet, John Keats, in his Ode to Grecian Urn, truth is beauty and beauty is truth. Truth and beauty are linked in a Socratic Platonic sense. And that's our essential motivation, or should be our essential motivation. But in order to fulfill that, we do physical, practical work. Right? Now, therefore, look at the problem of the United States today. We've got to save the United States, and a lot of other things as well. If we save the United States, a lot of other parts of the world are going to be happy. Parts of the world that are very unhappy right now with what the United States is doing to itself and others. We don't want the war. We don't want the depression. We don't want the brutality. Please take it away. Okay, if we do the right thing in the United States, that problem can be taken away. That's our job.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of LaRouche's keynote address to the ICLC Schiller Institute Labor Day Conference. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with LaRouche's keynote from our Labor Day conference.
Now let's look at George Bush sitting down there in Crawfish, Texas. Crawford, pardon me. Yeah. Sitting right next to the unsettled spirit of deceased David Koresh. Down there, Waco. They had this silly conference down there, a real carnival sideshow. Probably with belly dancers. It's a wonder that Sharon wasn't there. But here we are. He was confronted with something, and he had these clowns down there. And he didn't. His attention span is not the greatest. He's great on running. He's like some diseases. He's great on running, but not much on thinking. But he's down there. He could have done a little bit of thinking. I mean, we can rightly demand of a president of the United States a small amount of thinking. Perhaps not too much. We're going to strain that brain of his. But he's faced with this terrible depression, which is crushing us, about to crush us. And he's faced with a couple of problems, immediate problems in transportation. The railway system of the United States is crashing. Now, let's look a bit at this in this picture of the land bridge system crossing over into Eurasia from the United States. What you see there is connectedness. We now have the ability to move freight as well as passengers by existing known modes at speeds of about 300 miles per hour. We can move them quietly with magnetic levitation. We also can do a pretty good job with even friction rail systems. Not so good, but we can do it. That means that we have reversed potentially have reversed the great problem of humanity. For as long as we know ancient mankind, especially under conditions of repeated glaciation of the northern hemisphere, mankind's development was restricted to water. That is, movement, civilization, depended upon movement by water. Water because water is necessary for life, fresh water, for example. Water because the sea is a great source of food. If you try to build populations under primitive conditions, you rely largely upon water, fish, things of that sort, and transportation by water. It's obvious from what we know of the great ancient traces of calendars that the earliest civilization prior to, say, 10,000 BC, that period, the earliest civilizations were largely riparian civilizations, transoceanic and riparian civilizations. That people travel long distance. Some of the characteristics of these ancient astronomical charts tell us that. Hymns, for example, Vedic hymns. They indicate that mankind had knowledge of things which mankind would not have thought to have knowledge of unless it was an ocean-going culture. For navigation, very precise. The first science, the first physical science that we know of with any coherence came from ancient calendars. As the very late in the game, you have the Great Pyramids at Giza in Egypt, which are an expression of this long process of tens of thousands of years earlier. So man moved by water. Civilizations were by water. When the northern hemisphere was largely covered, where was civilization? It was largely in such places as the Indian Ocean. The seas were about 300 to 400 feet below what they are today, the ocean levels. And people traveled by water. And you had ancient cultures from the subcontinent, which were all over the area, traveling by water. There were transoceanic cultures, which existed at some earlier point. Man did not discover the New World suddenly in the 15th century, 15th century. Man had been traveling back and forth across the Atlantic for a long period of time. The route that Columbus took is a route which had been feasible for a sailing craft such as of the Viking type even much earlier. The route is the same. Once you knew the trick of the game, you could do it if you were a good sailor. Maybe at some risk, but you could do it. So then we moved to inland cultures, and we saw this in the history of modern European and other civilization. Movement up river cultures, large rivers, as in the case of Mesopotamia, which was a barren area until it was colonized from the subcontinent. And this subcontinental culture of Sumer moved up. The Semitic population, which were largely sea herders or something, began assimilated to this Sumerian Sparta culture, moving up the Tigris and Euphrates. The Nile is another example of this. The rivers in China, the same kind of thing. Man began to move inland from the seas by water. Then we began to develop inland systems, canals and so forth. Not quite so efficient, but they worked. Now, if you look at Asia, this map again. Now, the central part and central part of Asia is an area which is not very habitable. Part of it is Arctic tundra. Much of it is almost semi-desert or desert. It is thinly populated, but underneath the soil are large amounts of natural resources, mineral resources, one of the greatest, probably the greatest concentration on this planet. Other concentrations are the South African Shield and also South America are great concentrations of mineral wealth. For all humanity, you have then on the coasts of China and India and inland, you have populations which need these resources. They don't have enough in their own territory for their present and future needs. Therefore, they need development of these resources in the northern part and central part of Asia. Now, how can you develop resources? You must build a logistical system which can support the development of these resources. This is in the middle of a land area. Well, how do you do it? Well, by developing not only many rail connections across Asia, efficient rail connections, but also by developing corridors of development, the way our transcontinental railway system developed the states of the West through large agriculture and other developments on either side of the railroad of the transcontinental system. So the same kind of thing there, but in a more modern way. We have now the possibility, going from places like Busan at the tip of Korea, to all the way to Rotterdam and other places in Europe, of a continuous route whereby the ocean travel as a method of moving high-grade freight from one part of the world to the other is out of date. We can move the freight more cheaply, more quickly by land than we can by sea in terms of total economic cost. This means a transformation in the relationship of man's relationship to the planet. Suddenly the inland areas like the interior of China, Central Asia, North Asia, part the Sahara Desert, and other parts of this planet which were previously inaccessible to mankind for significant exploitation are now opening up to us through large-scale infrastructure. All right, now, that being the case, what should George have done? The transportation, rail transit system in the United States is collapsing. If we allow George to sit back and let the collapse of the national rail system continue, and don't save the possibility of recovery of the railway tracks that we formerly had, say, 30, 40 years ago. If we don't do that, the United States will cease to exist as an integrally functioning national economy. And we're at the point of no return now. Similarly, we have a crashing of the airline system, not the planes, but the system. Hopefully not the planes. I travel on a few of them. I'm not ready for that yet. I have a mission to do. All right, so therefore... therefore, what are we going to do? Because if we lose a functioning airline system, and if we lose the rail system, if we lose the integrity of the U.S. as a potential economy, an integrated economy, we're finished for a generation or more to come to rebuild. Therefore, George Bush, sitting on his something or other out there in Crayfish, Texas, should have said, well, there are consequences. We must do something about this, or there will be consequences. And what he should do is what we are going to have to get him or the government to do, at least to by November election time, we're going to have to burn the tail of the people and politicians of the United States to make sure that we have in the immediate future an emergency commitment to federalize in terms of support as an infrastructure project the entire existing and potential rail and air traffic system of the United States. That's the first step. It is not the only step. It is not the last step. It's a first step. The first step has the significance of this sort. First, we must show that we mean business. We must show that we mean business by taking an example of unquestionable urgency, the saving of the national transport system as a way of saving the integrity of the U.S. as a functioning national economy. We take those issues, not as exclusive issues, but as leading issues, of rebuilding an efficient rail system and saving the air traffic system and rationalizing it as a first step. That means that we will reduce the dependency in a fairly short period of time on short-haul air travel, because among the main trunk routes of the United States, we can move passengers more efficiently from downtown to downtown by use of rail transport, high-speed passenger rail transport, than we can by air. The time it takes for you to get out of the house in the morning to get to the airport, to line up to get searched and researched and researched at the airport before boarding the plane, and whether the plane takes off or not, or it's canceled, you have to wait for the next one, and getting back to the next airport, getting off that, finding a taxi cab driver who doesn't rob you. this is no way to run a railroad. So therefore, that's a first step, to rationalize, to take the problem of rail and air traffic as one problem, mass transit, mass traffic, and say we must integrate these two functions of air and rail so we have a rational system from the standpoint of the citizen and the standpoint of the economy. We want people to be able to move economically and efficiently from one place where they live or something to the place they want to do business. We want them to get there safely, and we don't want to have them sitting around waiting to see if the bus failed, or if the road got torn up or whatnot, or if cars don't work anymore. So we want that kind of system which is economical, convenient, comfortable, and gives the nation a sense we can get from one part of this nation to any other significant part in fairly good time. We can get to almost any part of our nation as fast as you can get from one part of Europe to another. We can do it. And that kind of objective, the assurance that we have economic security for freight as well as people, that our economy is integrated. Then we take areas that are dead areas, areas like Buffalo, New York, which is dead, areas like Michigan, which are dying, areas of Pittsburgh are dead. All the places that used to be the most productive centers, industrial centers in the United States, are dead. This Red Line thing in Los Angeles, they bought it up and shut it down. And now you have to build six more lanes of highway to get from one part of Los Angeles to the other, because that Red Line system went down. So rebuild these things, which were characteristic of what were formerly the most productive industrial centers of the United States, and also agricultural centers, because agriculture and industry were developed together in the United States, at least in a large degree. Develop that. Rebuild it. Rebuild the economy. Get back to business. Stop being a consumer society. Go back to being a producer society. And the first step is that. Now, the one other thing which is crucial, beyond that, beyond the transportation project, which I think should be the primary concern for all of us during the period up until the November elections. We want to turn the country upside down politically on the issue of this particular question as a positive measure, as a sublime action, something good, to do good for the people of the United States, and get these congressmen convinced they better do it, or else. Then we can get it done. So we will be doing things. We will get out. We'll have an EIR special report, which will contain a lot of information on this subject, which will be a resource for anybody who wants to study the question. That's in process now, and it will be produced very soon. We will have a pamphlet out soon by my campaign, which will take some of the highlights of this proposal and put them in pamphlet form, again, for mass distribution. We will put out a series of leaflets between now and November election time. The leaflets will change some of their content as appropriately as time goes on, but they will all be on the same theme, essentially focused on this question of rebuilding the infrastructure and the rail and air transport question as the leading issues. Those things we will do. Now, but beyond that, we've got to look at this water question. You've ever flown over the United States. Did you ever get from the 20-inch rainfall line, as it's called, in the Midwest to the West Coast? What are you flying over largely? The Great American Desert. For now nigh on 90 years or more, there has been no significant development, not counting Las Vegas, which I don't consider development. That's sort of Hollywood madam government territory. There's been no development of the Great American Desert. There's all that land area. There are very significant mineral resources out there. There is actually, under controlled conditions, agricultural potential, the potential for new cities, new industries in that area. The problem is we don't have water and power in there. The Parsons Company and others developed some years ago what was called the North American Water and Power Alliance. Now, water and power, apart from transportation, are the leading issues of infrastructure, on hard infrastructure, in the United States today. There will be bills put through by some of our friends in California to try to go back to an integrated system of regulated utility production and distribution of electrical energy, according to needs, and toward a policy of developing electrical resources, not based on price alone, but based on national strategic needs, as we used to do it. should be coupled with water management and the movement of the water from Alaska and northern Canada, presently going into the Arctic Ocean, moving much of that water down through a system which has been well designed into not only this great area of the Great American Desert, but to link that to the other water systems we have, such as the tributaries of the Mississippi system. We can link the entire nation from coast to coast and north to south. We can link it efficiently with inland water transport, which is not only a means of controlling the water distribution of the planet in our country, but also is a means of internal transportation of the kind of bulk freight which is best transported by water. For example, grain is a low value per ton bulk freight which is conventionally shipped by barge down the Mississippi and other routes. All right? Why? Because grain is something that comes to harvest at certain points. Therefore, you have a peak supply of harvested grains at those points. So therefore, you don't care, as long as the stuff is preserved, if it's in motion down river systems rather than being parked in a warehouse someplace. So the lost time in moving the freight from one loss to the other is not a loss, because you're not going to consume it all at once. So you're going to spread out the consumption of the grain in the whole cycle. So therefore, in that, such as coal and other low value per ton freight, which have that character, you can move it more easily by inland waterways. Inland waterways, if you take, for example, in the case of a state like Alabama, Mississippi, and so forth, the inland waterway system can be a boon to opening up areas which have not yet been quite civilized into healthy, functioning parts of society. So therefore, that's part of it. So that in general is what I'm up to. As I say, the key thing that's posed here, there are a lot of technical questions. I've touched on a few of them, which I thought were most important. But the key thing here is to get a sense of courage, of true courage. And the sense of true courage comes from recognizing what it is to be human. That we are not like an animal that whose life begins at birth and ends with death. But because we're human, because we're creatures of ideas, not simply animal behavior, we transmit culture from one generation to the next. We influence the way in which culture evolves through our participation in it. We do things which help steer that process, some at the cost and risk of their life. But if we do that properly, we have a sense of a certain immortality in us, that we are not creatures which are born and die. We have a mortal coil. We live within that mortal coil. But as individual human beings, as creatures of spirit, as creatures of mind, our span goes back to very ancient times, to the birth of the languages we speak, to the first ideas, scientific ideas, which we share today from ancient times. And we are linked also to the future we bequeath to those who come after us. If we have a sense of immortality, a sense of a person and a nation on a mission, then we will find from that we have a potentially infinite source of courage. And I'm contrary to the pessimists who say, you can't change things, you can't change things. I say, you don't understand man, you don't understand God. We can change things.
We're now going to turn to some questions and answers, but before we do, I've been asked to recognize Soher Sukari as a representative to the United Nations of the Arab Women's Association and a freelance journalist who should be there at the microphone.
Thank you very much. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Mr. LaRouche, we're also very proud of you. You just gave us hope. Whatever you say is not only educational, but definitely inspiring. And as an Egyptian, I can't help but see a very strong affinity between you and Akhenaton, who ruled Egypt 3,500 years ago. You and Akhenaton share something that is very close to everybody's heart. You both believe in the common good. Akhenaton decided to abolish all priesthood and abolish the plethora of gods and fighting and the divisive feelings this had created in ancient Egypt. And he unified. He came with the idea of monotheism, and he believed in the one and only God. He was the first one to believe in the oneness of God and the equality of mankind before this one God. Your strive to abolish oligarchies and to abolish the exploitation of human beings by other human beings, help each other for the common good, I can't help but see this affinity coming back to us. And in many, many aspects, you again remind me of Akhenaton. Akhenaton maybe is not known for the Americans as Akhenaton as such, but he is the father-in-law of King Tut. So most Americans know King Tut very well. Again, Mr. LaRouche, I did write a little note that will be in the festschrift given to you on the occasion of your birthday. And in the meantime, allow me to present you a poem written by Akhenaton for his God and only one God that unified the whole ancient world. I believe that no matter what happened to Akhenaton, his ideas are still alive in the heart of every good Jew, every good Christian, every good Muslim. Mr. LaRouche, as a child, I was brought up in an American missionary school. I'm a Muslim girl, and in school, I attended chapel every morning. And one day, I went to my father. I told him, I want to become Christian. I was 14. Father turned white. And he said, what for? I said, because Jesus brought to earth one word for religion, which is love. What else do we need for a religion? Father didn't answer for some time, and he said, but you are already a Christian. Why do you want the label? As a Muslim, Muslims believe in Jesus, don't we? I said, yes. He said, and you are a Jew. Muslims believe in Moses, don't you? I said, yes. He said, you'd better behave like a good one and don't worry about labels. Mr. LaRouche, you're the only one who talks like my father. Although I am not a young girl, but I'm just saying about the concept of doing good for humanity. And really, Mr. LaRouche, America needs you. We need a strong, intellectual, educated, good American to become president of this country. I want to join because this clapping is for you, Mr. LaRouche, not for me. And I would like just to say happy birthday. The poem will be in the, excuse me for the German word, the Festschrift. And whoever would like to read it, it's going to be there if they would like to acquire it. I would, if you kindly allow me to give it to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's keynote address at the Labor Day 2002 conference of the ICLC and Schiller Institute. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.